Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. Whether you're tuning in live or listening to the podcast, join me as we explore issues and ideas shaping our world with today's key thinkers and decision makers. So let's get started, sharp, relevant, and right to the heart of the story. Coming up on the program, we'll look into our crystal ball to find out what will happen to inflation and interest rates in 2025. And similarly, we'll look at new projections for the property sector. Why a civil society thought leader believes municipalities don't have a funding problem, but rather a spending one. Also, changes coming to WhatsApp and what you should be on the lookout for. It's Thursday, the 9th of January. South Africa's economy facing another potential challenge as new warnings about rising interest rates are coming into focus. Now, with global trends and local inflationary pressures at bay, what's this going to mean potentially for businesses, for consumers, and general overall economic growth? Joining me, Dr. Chris Haramsa from Sequoia Capital Management, an expert in financial markets and economic trends, and has been a guest on our program before. Chris, a very warm welcome to you. So maybe start by explaining the factors driving warnings about potential interest rate hikes in South Africa. There is a general sense, or at least was a general sense, that we were moving in a more positive direction. Do you necessarily share that view?
I do, in one sense, that the expectations that the repo rate will drop by another 100 to 150 basis points, I think that disappeared. After the Trump elections and Trump policies effect, even though policies was not introduced yet, but the effect already on the markets suggests that his policies, however being implemented, is a risk for higher inflation. Lizette Lakanyahu hinted at its last committee meeting press conference in that direction. And so due to that fact, we see the rand under pressure. We see oil prices rising now to about $676 an ounce. And we see also that the effect of Trump policies on tariffs will lead to a new wave of inflationary pressures in the world economy, and it will come over to South Africa. So it is now a sense that the Fed will only maybe cut by another 0.25, 25 basis points, but then it's it. So we may expect also maybe a 25 to 50 basis points drop in the repo rate, which will have now a severe effect on economic prospects in South Africa. And then also the fact that the rand may stay under pressure over the next 4 to 5 months. So the so-called high road scenario of the South African economy growing at 1.8 to 2% with interest rates 150 basis points lower and an exchange rate moving in the direction of 16 rand, I think that scenario at this stage is no longer applicable, and we rather moving to a normal situation or even a weaker situation in months to come due to these geopolitical factors. And then, of course, we're waiting for our budget coming in 6 weeks from now, and also pressure on the government of national unity to implement the correct policies. This all may have an effect on the fact that inflation may turn around from the current around 3% going up against over the midpoint of 4.5%. So it is so. The risk of inflation is now suddenly higher than it was 4 months ago.
So let me push you a little bit on inflation. As you rightly say, it does remain a key concern then. Do you think that the Reserve Bank is striking the right balance then between controlling inflation and also supporting economic growth? It becomes more and more difficult. That door, I would imagine, is closing very quickly.
It is. It was expected that we may see a 50 basis point cut to support economic growth going forward. And it seems though the Reserve Bank is more cautious on the risk on the upside. And if you read that report that he listed, looking at the government's wage account, he warned about that and the budget deficit. He warned about the fact that the rand will stay under pressure. He warned about the fact that we can see higher import tariffs. And let's not forget the big one, the fact that the AGOA negotiations may go south against us. So those are all the factors that the Reserve Bank at this stage, it's almost either choose inflation or choose growth.
Chris, the business sector is obviously very vulnerable in circumstances like this. How would an interest rate hike affect businesses and particularly SMEs? Many of these smaller companies are on the brink anyway.
No, they are. And the problem that we have is that last year, most of these companies could keep their head above the water due to the fact that we did not have load shedding. So they could survive, but the high levels of credit and high levels of interest rates and costs are outside, especially pressure on minimum wages and other wages, etc., is going to be quite a dire straits on SMEs this year. I think 100 basis points or even 150 basis point drop in interest rate, you know, should help a lot for these companies to stay abroad and keep their heads above the water. But the big problem now is here, if interest rates will not come down as we expect, the rand at higher levels. At this stage, it seems that there's a 56 cents increase in the petrol price at the beginning of February and diesel about 70 cents, given where we stand now. You know, all those aspects which will push up costs, again, of your small, medium-sized enterprise, you know, can contribute to job losses and can contribute to a lot of these guys that will not be able to continue anymore. And that, we know, that can have a devastating effect on economic growth. And then, as well, you know, we've seen what happened with the agricultural sector due to the constraints that they have to exports, etc., contributing to that low economic growth in the third quarter. And giving the range that we have now, floods that we're having now on the one side, some droughts on the other side, so will the agricultural sector recover? Because it was the surprise of the negative growth that brought South African economic growth down. So there's a lot of factors suggesting that we may not reach a 1.8% economic growth, and it may even maybe lower, maybe dipping under the 1% again. At 0.8 or 0.9%.
And Chris, just a final one. So much of this is predicated on policy change. There is the argument that more assertive structural economic reforms are needed and could reduce the need for more aggressive interest rate policies. How do you view that? Do you buy that argument?
No, I can't. I can't buy that argument. The moment that we lower, you know, from the monetary side, lower interest rate policies, the effect we've seen, the effect on the rand-dollar exchange rate and the rand exchange rate, for that matter, is devastating. You know, the moment that the real interest rate in South Africa comes down, especially if inflation is starting to increase, outflow of portfolio capital is going to kill us on the one side. And, you know, we've seen an exchange rate already vulnerable with Trump tariff policies. So, you know, it can push the rand over 19 in the direction of 20 rands a dollar. So that low interest rates will be more non-effective, because the lower real interest rates will affect the rand and inflation pressure so to such an extent that it will have such a devastating effect on the economy and economic growth more than the advantages of low interest rates.
Well, not necessarily the messaging that we want to hear at the start of the year, but I do appreciate, as always, the very accurate and realistic assessment. Dr. Chris Harmser from Sequoia Capital Management, thank you very much indeed, and I'm sure we'll talk to you again soon.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
South Africa's property sector is showing signs of optimism for 2025, buoyed by recent interest rate cuts, a rebound in retail and industrial markets, and a stabilizing office sector. With real estate investment trusts or REITs delivering some strong returns, the outlook is brighter than it has been in years, but I guess, is that sustainable? I'm going to talk now to Akhilan Ndlovu, who's an independent property analyst. Akhilan, welcome. So we ended last year on a high note as far as the property sector is concerned. What were the key drivers behind this positive momentum? Let's get some context first.
So last year was a great year. It was mainly driven by a couple of things. Beginning of the year, we saw increased institutional buying, mainly by the PIC. And then post that, we had the election outcome, GNU, which was quite positive for the sector. And then after that, we had September rate cut expectations, ultimately leading to the rate cuts. And we saw the sector continue to do well. And getting closer to the year, we saw good results coming from the property companies, great updates, results in pre-close.
So REITs particularly posting some impressive returns last year, if I'm not mistaken, in many respects, outperforming both equities and bonds. This says a lot, doesn't it, about investor confidence in the property sector?
Yes, I would say so, as well as patience. If you look at the sector, delivered over 29% total returns, beating equities, which did about 13% thereabout, and bonds at 17%. So it was mainly patience around waiting for the earnings outlook to improve, and we're seeing that happening with the sector, as well as balance sheets getting stronger and cash flows improving as well.
So you've noted a shift from net selling to net buying of assets in the sector. Is there a specific factor that is driving this change, and how significant would that be for the market?
Well, it's quite interesting. If you look at initially, the sector was selling lots of assets to help reduce the loan-to-value ratios. At some point, they were about 44%, and they've come down to about 39%. So the balance sheets are in good shape now, and property companies are ready to look for opportunities. As you saw last year, lots of buying across most of the retail sector, big shopping centers and malls. And we see that probably likely to continue, given that there's more capital available. And the sector was able to raise, in terms of equity raised, over 13 billion rand last year from book builds and dividend reinvestment plans. So the sector is in a better situation going forward.
Akhilan, you specifically point to retail properties like the Mall of the South here in Johannesburg and the Mall of Mthatha, which have seen notable acquisitions. The retail sector is attracting a lot of attention from investors. Is this purely an interest rate play?
Yeah, it's that as well, and the economic outlook, as well as vacancies. We're seeing them declining. They peaked at over 7% during the COVID era, and they're now at about 4 to 5% levels, and stronger shopping centers, some even below 3%.
Yet we need to be concerned about interest rates, a recurring theme in the property outlook last year. Obviously, these cuts do influence the sector's ability to raise capital and improve financial health. But Akhilan, you'll also agree with me that there are some warning signs on the horizon here that the interest rate environment in 2025 may not be as benign as we thought it was going to be towards the end of last year.
Sure, that's a good point. We saw that from the Fed as well, indicating potentially fewer rate cuts ahead. And at the end of the year, the listed property sector started to cool off based on that. And you have to watch out as well, with the sector having done so well, maybe short-term profit-taking and volatility, as well as pricing in less interest rate cuts going forward.
All right, so that's the retail sector. Let's look at the industrial sector, also outperforming last year. Is there a specific reason or a different set of reasons as to why this sector is so resilient? And might the trend continue in 2025, or could there be a potential pullback here?
Yeah, the general consensus, the industrial sector is likely to continue to do well. It's been fairly stable and consistent outperformer, mainly driven by warehousing, distribution and logistics, not much manufacturing. And given the positive growth in the retail space, that helps to support the industrial sector. So continue to likely to do well, and there's not much supply coming through as well.
Talking of supply, the office market, again, towards the end of the last year, was showing a degree of stabilization. But on my drive into work tonight, challenges still remain as far as high vacancy rates are concerned. The signs are outside many buildings. How long do you think it's going to be before we see any meaningful rental growth in this segment? Or are we going to have to wait a while?
So I'll say probably 18 months to 2 years, I'll say. If you look at the average vacancies, they are just under 14% for the office sector, having peaked at about 17%. But you have to be careful how we look at the office market, because it depends on the regions. For example, if you look at Cape Town, vacancies are about 6% or so on average, and Joburg is sitting at about 17%. So that's from a region perspective. And then the types of office buildings, if you look at your premium grade or your prime grade properties, they're under 8% vacancies. And then B to C grade, where you're driving around, seeing lots of those signs, they're like 16 to 17% vacant. Mm. So it's sector specific and location specific.
Keelan, 17% here in Johannesburg is worrying. That's disturbingly high. And again, that all comes back to infrastructural difficulties that the city is facing, and in many respects is not really getting to grips with it.
Yeah, that's one of the biggest challenges for the sector, decaying infrastructure and then increasing municipal charges as well to above inflation levels. So the sector, at some point, companies have to do look at their buildings and maintain, do stuff that's supposed to be done by the local authorities just to make sure that they get tenants and their malls and offices continue to work. So it's a big challenge, as well as the water issue.
So finally then, is there any specific advice you might give to potential investors looking to either enter or expand their presence in the property market in this country?
So in terms of earnings growth, the sector is likely to deliver probably 3 to 4% dividend or earnings growth, and that's likely to go above 5% later in the year or early 2026. So it's modest growth. And you're looking at yields of anywhere between 8 to 10%, depending which company you're looking for. So it's fairly stable. We've seen most of the great returns. So it's going to be more moderate growth going forward.
Keelan Ndlovu, thank you very much indeed. Independent property analyst, and I look forward to talking to you again in the near future.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
South Africa's municipalities are often described as being in financial crisis, but Wayne Duvenage from Outer is arguing otherwise. According to him, the problem isn't necessarily a lack of funding, but rather how the funds are managed or mismanaged. So here's the question then, why are municipalities struggling to deliver essential services despite these significant resources? What's really going wrong, and is it too late to turn things around? Wayne, a very warm welcome to you. So you argue that we don't have a funding crisis in municipalities. Maybe that's the starting point for this conversation. What's the real problem here?
Well, thank you, Jeremy. And the reason I pose that question, because we hear of municipalities saying we need more money, we need more bailouts. And so what I did is went back 15 years, so split the 33 decades of democracy into two halves and cast our minds back to 2010. Were as many municipalities as we have now broke? Were they paying their Eskom bills? Were they paying their water bills and so forth? And the answer is they were actually doing well. Not all, but most of them were doing well. And if you look at the revenue, the collective revenue of municipalities back then was about 154 billion rand. And if you add inflation and add another percent to that for developmental cost, add in another 1.6 average cost for population growth, you get to about today, they would be earning 442 billion. Mm. And in fact, they're actually earning 517 billion, 17% more than what they should be earning had they got all of these increases, which any organization would love to have been guaranteed back then if you looked 15 years forward. So the question then is, well, it's not really a case of not having enough money. They've kept well ahead of the pace of all these inflationary pressures and population growth pressures. And it comes down to, when you look at the Auditor General's reports, the cities and towns that are well managed, that don't have a funding crisis, that are able to produce growth incentives and growth environments, have investment, are municipalities that are well managed from a financial and a governance point of view. So it all comes down to leadership. The failing municipalities are squandering funds, they are employing consultants, they're throwing people at the problem, and they are paying service providers to provide infrastructure upgrades and services, but not getting the return for that investment. So it is a management issue.
In your opinion, what defines a well-managed entity then? Is there a standard protocol in your opinion?
Well, it comes down to, and again, the Auditor General spells it out in her reports, financial discipline, good governance, in less political interference, stability and management. So we have municipal managers and mayors in many of our towns and cities that come and go many times in the election period of 5 years. When you have that instability, you cannot drive the programs that you want to put in place for growth. There's so much inconsistency. And that comes from political meddling, and we see a lot of that in these broken municipalities. So let's get down to appointing people on merit. Obviously, you're going to, you know, I don't want to get into the whole debate of cadre deployment, but that's part of the problem. And cadre deployment is something that happens around the world. You don't mind political parties appointing people that align with their agendas, but they need to be sound and find the best people in for those roles that are going to carry out the positions that they are tasked with. That's not happening in our broken municipalities.
Wayne, national government on some occasions has stepped in to assist struggling municipalities in the past. Are these interventions effective? Do we need more of it? Or does this simply risk enabling poor management? In other words, to perpetuate the situation that you've already outlined?
It's perpetuating the problem, because how many of these municipalities are now not paying their Eskom bills because others don't pay, and they see, well, this is a nice recipe. We've got these massive bills that we don't have to settle, and we can spend money and squander money in other areas. So I believe that these constant bailouts are not doing any favors for local government. So what we need is Minister Hlabisa of COGTA to start focusing on getting the basics right on those failing municipalities. And I'm not trying to tar all of them with the same brush. I'm just saying collectively, if you just have a good look at it, we need to deal with the fundamentals. And if we don't, you know, at the national level, provincial and treasury level, we need to stop bailing out failing municipalities, obviously help them find the solutions. But the starting point of that is you cannot leave the people who create the problems in charge of the solutions. You have to put in the right management leadership and focus on discipline and financial hygiene.
I wonder if you're seeing any light here. On many occasions, we've seen residents now becoming more involved in driving accountability within their local municipalities themselves. That must be paying some sort of dividend, surely.
Yeah, it is. I think, you know, we're in a situation where we can't just sit back and complain. We have to roll up our sleeves as citizens, become active and do a number of things. Firstly, start doing it for ourselves. But if you have a municipality that wants to work with citizens and residents associations and business chambers, well, that's good, because then collectively we can find solutions and they can start holding them to account. But it's those municipalities, and unfortunately Joburg is one of them, where they ignore residents. When residents want to fix potholes, for instance, they get slapped on the wrist and fined and told not to do these things. That's not conducive to working with communities. So I think we're going to have to do a lot more of this, holding our local councillors and government to account and putting them under a lot of pressure.
As far as Johannesburg is concerned, and this is a final question, do you think we've reached some sort of desperation inflection point here where it's almost the problem is almost too big to save or to resolve now?
No, I don't think so. I think every day it gets worse. But our view is this, that there's no problem that's too big or too insurmountable. It just becomes longer to fix. But if you apply the disciplines, if we fix the management and get the disciplines in place, get the people back into the offices, for instance, into the Metro Center, which is just uninhabitable right now because leadership has just taken their eyes off that ball. There's so many things that are going wrong in Joburg. I do believe it is fixable, but we need urgent intervention in the city of Joburg now. It is still the economic powerhouse of South Africa, and it cannot be allowed to fail.
Wayne Duvenage is from the organization Undoing Tax Abuse. Wayne, thank you very much.
top stories to keep your eyes and ears on.
Now, WhatsApp, the world's most popular messaging app, is gearing up for some exciting changes this year. From augmented reality to reverse search features, the platform is set to revolutionize how we communicate with each other and interact with technology. I'm in conversation now with Toby Shapshak from the Stuff platform. He's a leading tech journalist and analyst. Toby, a very warm welcome. So WhatsApp has always been a game changer in the communication space. What can we expect this year?
Hi, Jeremy. Yes, Happy New Year. And what we're seeing is more features being added to WhatsApp, which is not surprising because it is by far the most used communication platform in the world. And it overtook just about everything last year. So what we're going to start seeing are AI features. And you've seen that already. You know, there's a little round circle, which is, you know, multicolored. That's the symbol that Meta, which is Facebook's new name, is using to represent the AI functionality. And basically, if you want to use generative AI or Gen AI, that's the easiest way for most people to use it. You can ask questions, you can find information. Personally, I tried it once or twice, but as you know, Jeremy, I don't trust Facebook, so I don't really trust their services. However, AI is the trend that is sweeping the world, and it's unavoidable that it's going to become part of it. And WhatsApp is a very useful tool for a lot of people. They're introducing it for business. So what you'll be able to do is, if you have a WhatsApp business account and you're not available, a chatbot can respond to people who contact their number and potential customers and help them solve their problems. And that's the kinds of services that we're going to see. Meta's own AI, a little symbol at the bottom. But what that will be is, in future, it will be on the tab at the bottom where you have a whole bunch of other things that I never use, like communities and whatever else. And that's where you'll be able to use it. So more than anything else, I think the way to think about it is that this is a conduit for Facebook to get its AR services in front of more and more people. One of the things you mentioned is the image search. So what you'll be able to do is check if an image that's been sent to you has been edited or taken out of context or manipulated. One of the biggest problems in the world is misinformation, and WhatsApp is by far the biggest source of misinformation because of its sheer size, but also because Facebook doesn't police anything else. So, you know, there's a lot of stuff that can get on that way. So they say this will help people check whether or not images have been manipulated or edited, or they're not current images.
Right. I mean, Toby, often test my thinking here and let me never stand in the way of progress. And adding new features, I guess, is always a good thing. We've got to march forward. But surely the joy of WhatsApp has always been its ease of use and its simplicity. Is there not a danger that it's overlaying us with too much?
I think that's a good way of putting it. I think danger is a nice way of saying they're taking an app that had one really good single function, Jeremy, and they're trying to add a whole bunch of other things to it. I don't remember how big the app is. I think the last time I looked, it was 300 or 400 megs. That's a lot of stuff to download. If you don't have Wi-Fi and you're a pay-as-you-go user using your own data to update your phone, that's 400 megs of data gone just for an app where you may never use the functionality that takes up so much of the space, the communities, the business services. So what happens is the phrase in the computer industry or the tech industry is bloatware. And that's the problem. The problem is it's becoming bloatware. Facebook was once a really good product for doing one thing. They try to do everything. Now it's useless at everything. Same with Instagram. And the only way Facebook knows how to make money is through advertising. So you get spammed with advertising all the time. So my fear is that WhatsApp will just become this big, clunky, everything app that people only use the bare minimum. It's worth remembering that in the age of 2G cell phones, right, before the iPhone, before smartphones, before 3G, the statistic was most people only use 20% of a cell phone's features. I mean, think about how much more stuff is in a smartphone. Most of us don't use it. Many people just use their phones for WhatsApp, pictures, and a few other social media apps. There's a bunch of functionality that you can use it for. The guy who shot the movie about Rodriguez searching for Sugar Man ran out of money and shot half the film on his iPhone. That's not what most of us are using it for. So that's my fear. My fear is you're taking something that's really good at doing one
one thing, which is messaging and communicating, and they are trying to turn it into a gateway for their AI services, a business communication tool. And all that means is that every single one of us people who just uses it for messaging is downloading new 300 more megs than they would ever need to use.
So where does this leave its competitors like Telegram and Signal, for instance, which are a lot simpler to use?
Look, I think they're very specific markets, those apps. I think WhatsApp has taken over everything. Telegram is something of a free-for-all. The CEO was recently arrested because there was a failure to do any checking of information and misinformation and disinformation. Telegram's a very powerful tool. I know some people who use very clever techniques to draw in a whole bunch of information for themselves. But it's also a propaganda tool. The Russian invasion of Ukraine, all of the Russian information, all of their propaganda is all over Telegram. You know, and the founder is Russian and left Russia and put his servers, he says, in Switzerland, so he wouldn't have these problems. But basically what you have is a service that is a free-for-all with no control. Anyone can have a channel. There are lots of neo-Nazis and right-wingers who use it. Signal is a much more specific device. Signal is entirely for encrypted communication. It's a very good product. The encryption is very secure. In fact, WhatsApp uses Signal's encryption technology, but it's very limited. And it's like a network, any network. The more people on a network, the better the network is. One fax machine is pretty useless. Two fax machines is very useful. 10 fax machines is very, extremely useful. So the more people on a network, the more people you can contact. I wanted to get off WhatsApp completely, and I realized it's a fool's errand. You cannot just abandon the most used communication network, but that's the world we live in. The thing I think that we're going to see more of, Jeremy, is AI becoming part of every service. And what I'd like to warn listeners is just because people say we have AI, we do AI, it doesn't mean that it's great, and it doesn't mean that it's really helpful. Right now, I don't think the AI services are groundbreaking. What AI is really good at is summarizing things and telling you short things, but it often gets it wrong. I mean, I've aggrieved that the word they've chosen for software glitches. So when Gen AI just makes stuff up and, you know, if it doesn't know what the case law is, it just invents the case law, as happened to some poor lawyer in America. It just makes it up. So our expectations of what AI is going to do for us is out of sync, obviously, because we all think it's much more sophisticated than it is.
Just a final one then, Toby. We've got all of these updates coming to WhatsApp. Do you think it's going to signal a shift in our behavior? In other words, the way in which we interact with WhatsApp, and particularly in our daily business and communication dealings?
I think that change has already happened in the world. I think WhatsApp's become more than just a personal communication system. They're business accounts. I interact with a lot of people. Checkers 6060 sends me messages, tells me all sorts of things. That's useful to me. If I opt in, Jeremy, I think that's what's useful. There are a lot of people I know who've decided to start a podcast, and whether I've asked them to or not, every week they send me a link to their podcast. And I've said to them, please don't. I've subscribed on Spotify. I can get it myself. But they don't do that because they have an intention. And I find that, I don't know how else to put it, it's like rude. I didn't ask permission. You didn't ask my permission. I didn't ask you to start using a communication channel as a source of spam. And in fact, I will double check this, but if I'm not mistaken, the legislation actually covers it. If you do not opt in, then you are spamming people. But I'm probably the only one who's pedantic about that kind of thing. I get so much email spam. My biggest fear is that people have replaced the functionality of other services like email with WhatsApp. I'll give you an example. Someone sends you a calendar invite. They don't send you a calendar invite that sits in your diary. So they send you a Zoom link for a meeting or a call or an interview. No one sends us an email, so it sits in my diary, which is useful for me. They send a Zoom link in a WhatsApp message. Therefore, I have to, if I want to put it in my calendar,
you've got to do the work.
Export that information. I've got to do the work. Whereas, you know, it's sure it's easy and accessible, and obviously the younger generation are much more comfortable with it and use it much more. But there's a lot of things that are being sacrificed along the way.
Toby Shapshak, I'm going to leave you to wade through your spam box. We'll do this again in the not-too-distant future. Toby Shapshak from the Stuff platform. He is a leading tech journalist and analyst. Toby, always appreciate your time. Thank you. And that's our program for today. Back tomorrow with another 30 minutes of issues driving South Africa's business, political and social environment. Thank you for listening and goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.